what I'm pissed off about. I am sitting here watching a team play at exactly the same level of those guys. You know who they are? Nine guys named Joe that you can find anywhere. Really? Really? You know who you are? You are the best baseball team in America. If you can stick to the fundamentals and build a fire in your to get competitive on an inning by inning basis where no one is ever going to take anything away from you. But we are not going to get something for nothing. We have got to pay the price that baseball demands. It demands everything. Courage. It demands intelligence. It demands toughness. This is important. Not because of the fans, but because of what it does for you as you mature and you grow. You start to get mentally tougher so that anything you want to do in your entire life, you'll be able to outcompete anyone around you. You know how to pay the price. You have a work ethic. You have a focus. You have the ability to be intense. You have the ability to have the courage to make the decisions, to act on your thoughts, which is what life finally ends up all about being all about. Having the courage to act on your own ideas and become who you want to become. What a privilege.
Are you worried that recent events have derailed your retirement plans? It certainly made us reassess all aspects of ours, and that's why we're proud to offer our listeners a chance to work with David McClellan, a fiduciary financial advisor from Forum Financial. David's practice specializes in financial life coaching and retirement planning, and right now he's offering free consultations for our listeners if you mention the podcast. As part of this consultation, David can help you understand your financial freedom number and what that means to you in assessing your future financial plans. If you want to build wealth, if you want to make optimal decisions within your financial life, David is someone you need to talk to. You can reach him at 312-933-8823. Once again, that's David McClellan at 312-933-8823. He's located in Austin, Texas, but he's got a nationwide clientele. Do yourself a favor and get some great financial advice for free and see if you might want to work with Mr. McClellan. I think you'll be happy with your phone call.
Everyone Gets a Trophy podcast. I'm joined by none other than a Longhorn baseball guy who's been a listener of the podcast for a while. He has been a perhaps participant in a future Wadlington Longhorn pitcher challenge based on Kevin being an instigator and a troublemaker. And all-around great dude and the pride of Yoakum, Texas. I'm talking about none other than Longhorn legend pitcher Randy Boone. Randy, thanks for being my special guest, man.
Man, I'm so happy to be here. Like I said, long-time fan of you guys. Love listening to you, and glad Kevin's still instigating that, because I'm gonna need a couple months to get in shape, but I would like to do that at some point in time.
Kevin will not let this go, and we're gonna talk about it. We're not gonna bury the lead right now. We're gonna get into it later once we get the whole Randy Boone origin story. But Randy's an awesome dude. He's been a listener to the pod. He kind of came to the pod through Kevin, and he's not held it against me that I like to talk shit about baseball and mock the athleticism of baseball players. Part of it's shtick. Part of it is I just like to say things that'll irritate Kevin, which I appreciate. Part of it is also real. And I've had actually numerous baseball players say, yeah, that's fair. I don't care. No, like, you're not hurting my feelings. He's like, and they're all like, by the way, you can't hit a 95 mile per hour fastball. So don't think you can. And they're like, your vertical leap ain't going to help you. And I was like, you're right. That's 100% correct.
Very true. Very true. Yeah, it's kind of an intricate skill. But I don't think I ever got to 95, but there was plenty of people at the end of my career that could hit a fastball of mine. So thus, I no longer do it.
Well, that is when you have to hang up the old cleats, when too many guys catch up to you and your crafty veteran status isn't working anymore, right?
Yeah, crafty veteran goes out the window when you start backing up third base a lot. So
that's true. Well, all right. I said you're the pride of Yoakum, Texas. That's no joke. Randy, you grew up in you didn't grow up in Yoakum. Where were you born?
I did not. I was born in Yoakum, but I grew up about 15 miles outside of Yoakum in a little community called Hope. They had a K through 8 school, I believe My dad was born in 51, and I think he made it through sixth grade there. So whatever that equates to. And then they, you know, combined with Yoakum ISD. So that school's still there. It's like the local community center. But yeah, growing up out there, we lived on an acre. We had, some farmland down the road. So, cows, that whole deal. I had a cousin that lived kind of down the road around the corner, and that was pretty much, my entertainment was me and him and, anybody else you could convince to come over to the house. But there was a whole lot of tennis balls off the wall and off the brick fireplace and, kicking the football. You're the kickoff guy and the return guy. And, my dad made me some PVC goalposts at one point because I was a field goal kicker too. It was good. I was fortunate to have a lot of support out there. And, then once I went to a little community school named Ezel. It was about halfway between Yoakum and Hallettsville, K through eighth grade. I came in and did sports in eighth grade in Yoakum. They had like a deal to where, we played flag football and did stuff like that at Ezel, but we didn't have, official UIL sports, so you could come in and do that. So, when somebody would pick me up in the afternoon, I'd come in to practice for football and basketball. K through eight out of Ezel, I think I graduated with seven kids. In our eighth grade class, and half went to Yoakum, half went to Hallettsville, and we popped into Yoakum, and I think our whole high school was 440 people, and my first class at UT was like 520 something. It's like, all right, well, this is gonna be a little different, but let's do it. So
where you're from, that area, which is an area of Texas I actually love, that's Aggie country, isn't it?
Heavily. Yeah, heavily. I really don't have a good story as to why I grew up a Texas fan. My current boss lived right down the road from us. His family had no collegiate ties to Texas, but they were huge Texas fans. There's a couple other people in the area that we were close friends with that my dad knew through the oil business or cattle or whatever. I don't have a good reason. And I guess we can get into the background of the story now, but my junior year in high school, I had been talking to Texas a little bit, Coach Harmon, Coach Anderson, just through some, normal recruiting stuff and kind of feeling everything out. And, they were going to come see me and things missed and, they finally came and saw me or whatever, but, it's kind of we're still talking, trying to figure things out, if they were interested, if it was going to work type deal. I had a good tournament in front of Coach Lawler, who was pitch coach at A&M at the time. And went up there on a visit. There was a guy that was just ahead of me in school that was up there. And I actually had a scholarship offer ready to sign on my desk in the fall of my senior year. I don't remember how the timeline works out on all that, but I was going there, like, so I haven't taken this offer, like, it's there. I always wanted to go to Texas. I just, at that point in time, I didn't really know if it was going to work or if they were going to have room. And the A&M guys, to their credit, were honest. I'm like, hey, this is what we got now. Don't know if it's going to be there if you wait next semester type thing. I had it, like I said, I had it on my desk in my room and couldn't pull the trigger. And I walked out and told my dad, I was like, hey, I'm going to roll the dice and we're going to see where this thing takes us next year or end of the season. And,
okay, hold
thankfully,
on.
Go ahead.
Was your dad like, holy hell, son, this is a ride to a major college. I mean, you're a 16-year-old kid betting on yourself. Where did you get that confidence?
Yeah, to be honest, I don't really know. I mean, maybe I didn't know any better at the time. Like, I don't have a good reason as to why, but I just always wanted to go to Texas. Like, that was, if it was in the cards, that's where I was going to go. So I walked out and told Dad, and, Dad and Mom were in the living room. I was doing it in my room at the time, and walked out. I was like, hey, I'm going to roll the dice on this thing. And they said, hey, we'll figure it out.
Awesome.
And, it you know, I don't remember the exact deal, but it wasn't a full ride. I mean, you know how the 11.7 thing works or whatever.
Yeah, you didn't go to Dallas Baptist.
I'll say it. Well, yeah, I didn't get a private school cheating scholarship deal. Can you say that now? But
yeah, we can say whatever we want here.
Yeah, that's true. But you know, it was a school that was beholden to the actual 11.7. I don't remember the exact number, but it was. I'll say this: it was more than what I ended up with at Texas, but that's fine.
Yeah.
Because I ended up where I wanted to go, and really the only other thing, I took a visit to Arizona. That was kind of just like a random spur of the moment. Hey, I'm gonna go see Arizona. Really didn't anticipate trying to make a decision on that when we sat down on Sunday before I went home. You know, the offer that they made was something that kind of made me scratch my head. But you know, family really wouldn't have been able to come see me play and stuff like that. And once again, it all comes back to if Texas wanted me, I was going there regardless. And like I said, my folks were, you know, supportive. And fortunately, I came from an extended family and a bunch of stuff that, you know, we were going to make it work regardless of what it was. So, yeah, like I said, moving in that season, Coach Anderson came to see me pitch a couple of times. And stayed in contact with Coach Harmon and talked to Coach Garrido, you know, a few times in the allowable windows or, you know, whatever. And it worked out and ended up there.
How were these strip clubs in Tucson?
We actually didn't make it to any.
Okay.
I can honestly say that. But my host, they set me up with a guy from Texas that was out there. Name's John Malone. He pitched a little bit in the big leagues with the Dodgers. Great guy. It was an awesome trip. The city was pretty cool. I never obviously really been out there before. But it was a cool spot. And, you know, the guys on the team were, it was kind of a hodgepodge. You know, you had some Arizona guys, you had some Southern California guys. But, you know, Coach Lopez was there at the time. And he had kind of established his recruiting ties in other places of the country. So they got some, you know, some Texas ties and some stuff, you know, around the country. But I actually went and that visit was during the season. And if memory serves correct, I think they played a series against Washington. And I think that was the first, like, legit college baseball series that I was able to, like, sit and, like, really watch.
Really?
And, it you know, it was eye-opening because, I mean, I really didn't grow up going to Texas games or whatever because we always had, you know, we were at a, you know, football deal or a basketball deal or a baseball deal pretty much year-round.
That's true.
You know, we went and watched the high school state tournament if I wasn't participating. Well, I say we were there 1 year. So 3 of the 4 years I was in high school, we went and watched it. But, yeah, I didn't grow up going to games at UT. You know, watching them on TV when they were on TV back in the day. But I mean, most of my memories of Texas baseball were, you know, late 80s World Series, you know, Stephen Larkin, Brooks Kieschnick, Kip Harkrider, you know, Braxton Hickman. You know, that's my first memories of, you know, Texas baseball, you know, Coach Gus and, you know, those teams that were just perennially there every year, it seemed like. I was kind of fell in love with the deal.
Yeah, so I grew up in Austin, and so I didn't realize till I talked to you how spoiled I was, as baseball wasn't even my favorite sport, but of course I went to Texas baseball games because it's Texas baseball, like it's just iconic, right? And so as a little kid, we would all just like get bored a little bit watching the game. Although sometimes I'd get enthralled, depending. I don't know if you remember a guy. This is before your time. There's a dude named Scott Coolbaugh.
Oh yeah,
and Scott Coolbaugh was a really good player. I think he was a third baseman, and he had some power, and he had a cool name. And when he'd come up, the announcer would go, "Scott Coolbaugh," and like the girls would all be like, "Woo!" And he had like a little batting motion where he'd like do like a hip circle, like Elvis or something.
Oh, yeah.
And so, Kyo's in the stands would be like, "Ooh, Scott!" And so as a little boy, I was like, oh, Scott Coolbaugh is cool. I'm going to watch this. Kevin Garner was on those teams, all those guys. So, but when I wasn't watching that, I would go find other kids, random kids I didn't even know. We'd grab cups, like paper cups, and bunch them up and play stickball underneath the stands. And then when the relievers and closers would go warm up out behind the bleachers, we just go back there and chat with them. And like,
yeah, it used to be right there, right?
And we'd fetch balls and if they saw a hot chick in the stands, they'd send one of us to go bring her a note. Like, it was awesome. And I remember one time, I was out there and I mean, I was a really little kid, but Clemens and Schiraldi, like that team, they invited me into the locker room after the game. Like, you're a cool kid. Come stop by the locker room. We'll give you autographs. And I went in and got autographs, Spike Owen and all these different guys. And like, as a little kid, you think those guys are like freaking legends. Like I thought Roger Clemens was 7 feet tall. I mean,
pretty much. Can you imagine what would happen if you did that today?
Oh, I mean, yeah, it's a different world. It's just a different world. You know, we're so much more uptight.
But yeah, no, kids used to be there, you know, back when it was right there down the third baseline and before it all got flipped over. But I guess this was my whole career because the renovation was going on during my senior year. But yeah, I think
you played at Round Rock.
Yeah, we had to play a regional in Round Rock.
What a weird, stupid deal that was.
Yeah, it wasn't ideal for us.
No.
But that wasn't ideal. And then we got like the number 10 team in the nation as a 2 seed, as the number 2 overall seed, which is a little interesting.
Well, who was that?
UC Irvine.
Oh, that's right. The Anteaters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They came in about as hot as you can come in. And I mean, it's a good ball club. I mean, nothing against them, but I mean, they were about as hot as you could be at that point in time. And I don't remember exactly, but I think they were like number 9 in the nation in the rankings. And yeah, we got them as a 2 seed, as like the number 2, you know, overall seed. It's kind of like, interesting.
That is interesting. Well, to give people a context of when Randy was there and pitching, he was there at a pretty amazing time between 2004 and 2007. That was not just an amazing time for UT baseball. You won a national championship. You were runner up, what, as a freshman?
In 04, yep.
Yep. Yes. And that game was winnable.
Wasn't that the Cal State
Fullerton team where that second game they had that pitcher who kept leading with the changeup and just our hitters were confounded. Like every count we were starting off 0-2.
Yeah, no, he pitched backwards about as good as anybody you're gonna see. And his changeup was about as good as you're gonna see in the college.
It was unreal.
And I mean, he made a decent little run in the. I don't think he ever got to the quote unquote big leagues, but he had a decent little minor league career as well. And then of course Ricky Romero was their ace, and I actually played with him in the Toronto system. And he liked to bring that up about as frequently as he could. when he would come down and talk to the minor league, the peons down there, but. Ricky had a real good big league career, but they definitely had the pitching. I still put that 04 team up against pretty much anybody in the game.
That was a badass team.
And you don't get credit for it because only 9 people played at once. But I mean, literally, if you'd split that team in half, I mean, I think we'd probably been at least, I mean, worst case scenario, probably first and third in the conference.
Who were the headliners on that team? There's a lot.
Houston. Houston Street was our closer. Jay Brent Cox was a setup guy. Buck Cody was kind of another setup guy from the left side, and he had an unbelievable year that year. He actually ended up coming back the next year and tried to start a little bit and probably didn't have the year that he wanted to. But he was a great leader on that 05 team. I'll say that. But he had an unbelievable year in 04. That was kind of the back end of the bullpen. Then you had JP Howells, our Friday night guy, who obviously had a long big league career. Sam LaCure was a Saturday guy, and then Justin Simmons, was coming off like pitcher of the year as a sophomore the year before. Threw on Sundays, just kind of basically because they wanted to go left, right, left. But I mean, any of those three guys could have been the Friday guy anywhere in the nation. And then you had, Kyle McCullough, who ended up being a first rounder, was a freshman with me. Me and him kind of split the Tuesday middle relief stuff. Kyle Yates was another guy that got a
double-A,
triple-A with the Blue Jays ahead of me. It's kind of funny, me and Yates, and I actually, Yates had the double-A New Hampshire record for wins there for a little while, and then I broke it. It's, you can say it's good or bad that you were in double-A for that long, but
double-edged sword.
He was there. That was kind of like the three-man Tuesday middle relief deal. And then, I mean, there was several other guys on that team that had, you know, good minor league career. I mean, we had Matt Goodson, I think, threw like two or three innings that year and was like an 11th rounder and made it to Triple-A with the Red Sox. I mean, it was like the depth on that team was just something that I don't think you'll ever see it again in this era of college baseball. But, I mean, our inner squads, I mean, it was dumb. It was like, I mean, unless you were playing the top-tier team, the inner squads were, you know, probably worse than, you know, your normal Tuesday or Sunday.
That's awesome. Yeah, you know, it's funny you brought up Buck Cody. So, Randy, yeah. I realized I remember the first time I saw you pitch, or I remembered seeing you pitch, and it was against Rice at Reckling.
At Rice, yeah.
And freshman year. You and Buck Cody split the game and dominated Rice. They didn't score. You shut them out. And I remember you specifically because you were young and you did a good job. They had a couple of hits, but they were like garbage hits. And I swear to God, I saw this. There was a pitch and it was a strike and the umpire called it a ball. And you rolled your eyes. The camera caught you rolling your eyes. Do you remember this? Have you ever heard this?
Yeah, I wish I'd have been a little bit better at hiding my emotions with umpires back in the day. One thing that with maturity comes knowledge, I guess. But I don't remember the Rice one, but I'm sure it happened.
That's awesome.
But I do know in 05 in the World Series, that's something. My friends like to bring up quite a bit. I threw a backdoor slider on a 3-2 count against Florida. And I guess it would have been the seventh or the eighth. And it, I mean, if you watch the video, I mean, it's a ball. It's outside. By
That's great.
But at the time, I didn't believe so. And I was about halfway to the dugout and they called it a ball. And I was like, yeah, it's probably not the best thing to do there. But like I said, it's youth and exuberance sometimes outweigh what you know.
Exactly. Well, that's awesome. Yeah. All right. I like to rag on baseball. I like to rag on baseball players, right? That's part of my shtick. But you played like everything. You were like that dude in high school. You were the quarterback for the football team. What did you play? Point guard on the basketball team?
I was a wing. I was basically the guy that you watch when Duke is really good. And they have the guy that takes all the charges and then there's people that I hate when I watch basketball.
Yeah, honestly, exactly.
That was me. Like I knocked down an open three. I'd play defense. But yeah, no, I was nervous.
You were ahead of your time, Randy. You were the original 3-and-D.
That's right. Yeah, that was right. But I was probably like the second or third string point guard, but I could run the offense if they needed me to, but that was not what I was bringing to the table.
All right. Well, you were the quarterback.
I was, yes.
All right. And your hated rival is the Cuero Gobblers.
Correct.
All right. So not long ago, I was driving to Rockport with my family to go stay at a condo and do some beach things and fish and do all that good stuff with my son. And I drove through Cuero and I was like, oh man, he's from like right down the road. So I took pictures of the Cueros, like welcome to Cuero, yeah. Cuero Gobblers high school sign. And I sent it to Randy and I was like, these sons of bitches, can you believe, you know, trying to rile him up. And he was like, nah, that was like the cool town. They were fashionable or like, that was like the in place, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I actually work there now, so I can't say.
You can't anything. Say anything or the Gobbler Mafia will come after you?
We're based out of there. I don't have any jobs there, but you know, the office is there. But yeah, I mean, you know, they still get their get their enjoyment out of watching turkeys race. So
you That's take, right. that
for what it, take that for what it's worth.
Well, but, and they also, I told you, they disgraced your statue in the Yoakum Town Square.
Yeah, if there was a statue there, they probably would, but there's no statue.
There is a Randy Boone, he's being modest, there's a Randy Boone statue in the Yoakum Town Square, and every year the Cuero Gobblers put women's panties and a negligee on it to dishonor this great man. Yeah. And I wasn't having it. I tore it down and I yelled at the kids that I saw doing it. So Randy, I had your back, man.
Well, I appreciate the effort on your part.
All right. But here's the real question I need to know. All right.
All right.
You played baseball. Obviously you were excellent at baseball. You played basketball. You were average.
We'll go with average.
Football. You're a good player. You're the starting quarterback. If you had been as good in baseball as you were at football or basketball, what would have been your preferred sport in college?
I'd have probably still stuck with baseball, honestly. But I'm probably more of a nerd when it comes to football tactics than I am the baseball side of things. I mean, I'm 6'2". Barely, well, our offensive line wasn't exactly the, you know, meanest and tallest offensive line in the history of the world. So I could see over them, but I knew if I went to the next levels, you know, I was going to be Drew Brees in it, trying to pick windows and whatnot.
But hold on. Remember the premise. You're as good at football.
Oh, I'm as good. That's right. I'm as good.
As you are at baseball. You're a starting college quarterback. You're a freaking stud. You get to go out there on Saturdays in front of 90, 100,000 people.
I'm going to still have to go baseball on it just because it was always my first love or whatever. But like I said.
But that's the wrong answer.
Well, according to you. But when it comes to like tactically breaking down the game, like I'm much more of a football nerd than I am, you know, a baseball guy. Like I get into the weeds and on pitch selection pretty good. I'm sure I bore people that I work with all the time because we'll watch a game here and there.
Yep.
You know, about, you know, what a guy's trying to do and this and that. And, you know, I honestly learned more from hitting coaches in pro ball that, you know, I just sit there and pick their brain like, hey, if you were hitting right now, what would you be doing? So that's kind of where I got in. That's where I like to get in the weeds in baseball. But as far as the overall game, the overall strategy, the football side kind of interests me more, I guess, is, you know, why do you run the shell cover three versus a two high versus single high and stuff like that. And when I was in high school, we ran basically a pro style eye offense. And even my first game starting, they gave me quite a bit of leeway at the line of scrimmage. You know, I didn't have a ton of options to choose from when it came to audibles, but they did trust me to get into the right play. So I had to learn pretty quickly, you know, what plays are good against certain defenses and this. And the, I guess the chess match of that kind of parallels the chess match of being a not overpowering pitcher, which I never was. You know, you're constantly trying to move people around and do stuff. So I guess that kind of parallels, and I guess that's why that interests me as much as it does. All things considered, if I was equally talented, I'd probably still went with the baseball route.
All right, I accept your answer.
Unless
I wanted you to portray baseball and say football.
The only caveat I'll give you there is I was actually, for whatever reason, I probably dating back to the time where I kicked a football in the backyard and then went and picked it up and kicked it to the other end of the yard. I was actually a pretty good punter. And there's a guy from East Bernard, which is kind of right down the road here, and about named Shane Leckler.
Oh, yeah.
That did that for like 25 years in the NFL and made, you know, a couple $1 million a year to not get hit. So maybe that would have been something I would think again about.
You would have signed up for that.
Yeah, I think that would have probably meant something.
One thing that is interesting is, I mean, there's no doubt quarterback's the most important position in football, particularly in modern football, right?
Yes.
But there's no other sport where a singular player, the pitcher, can absolutely determine the game outcome. If you're a dominating pitcher, it just doesn't really matter. If you're on, what the other team has or what they bring to bear is sort of irrelevant. Like when Randy Johnson is feeling it in his prime, it's just you're irrelevant. It doesn't really matter what your plan is as a hitter.
Yeah, you're looking for the two mistakes he's going to make that game, and hopefully you hit one of them.
Yep.
And yeah, but no, you're 100% right. I mean, you're standing out on a hill in the middle of the field with, you know, 40,000 people staring at you. You are in control of the whole thing. So
that's got to be a cool.
It's a pretty cool feeling, but it's also a really lonely place if things aren't going well.
Well, your childhood prepared you for that.
This is true. This is true.
This is just another tennis ball off the garage door.
That's right.
What's funny is I grew up in a neighborhood full of kids, and I played every one of those games that you did. Another one I did was I'd throw the football up on the roof.
Oh, yeah.
And then I'd stand under the roof where I couldn't see where it was going to fall. And then I'd dive to wherever it was going to fall and then get all skinned up and bloody, and my mom would yell at me for messing up another shirt.
No, that definitely was in the playbook back in the day. That and my little, like, back into my football geek deal, but I had a spiral notebook where I'd draw plays for, you know, Ken and Chris and all my imaginary friends.
That's awesome. Yeah, I sadly even extended that to college, playing in the intramural leagues. Like, I was the guy who, like, figured out how to play, you know, flag football. What's the most effective defense? What's, you know, what can you do in the rules of that? Like, how can you make stuff work? And it's one of these, you know, football, you can game it, you know, if you have some technical acumen, and I'm sure my teammates were like, dude, we're just having fun, man. Like, do we really have to, like, study defenses?
Yeah. I think with what you just said is kind of like the great equalizer, like, you know, football, you know, we played teams that were much bigger, better, probably, if you look at it, than we were. You know, we had much, you know, our offensive line was small, but we'd cut people and get after the legs, and we'd run toss sweep. And by the, you know, third, fourth quarter, they're tired, and we hit them, and, you know, we try to go over the top of this. So it's like the great equalizing ability in football is you can out-scheme somebody as long as you can stay in the game long enough for your scheme to work, right?
Yeah, that's a great point.
You can't out-scheme somebody when you get down 35-0 in the first quarter, which happened to us a couple times as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, in baseball, like you said, if Randy Johnson's out there and he's feeling it, you better try to win 1-0.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
That's about your only option, you know. So, but that's why you play 162 games in baseball instead of, you know, 13.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's a game of large numbers. And you know what else is a game of large numbers?
Mortgages.
Mortgages. Look at that. That's a freaking mind meld.
Hey, I'm a three-time client in Gay Winslow right now. So
you know what? I'd forgotten that, Randy.
Yeah.
So talk about extolling the virtues of Gabe Winslow. So you guys know Gabe in this podcast. He's been our sponsor from the start. We have scores of satisfied customers. I think we may be getting close to 100. And Randy is responsible. He might be our most frequent customer. So I might just shut up and let Randy hold forth here. But if you want to reach Gabe Winslow, you can go to mortgagesbygabe.com, or you can call him at 832-557-1095. Randy, are we a satisfied customer of Gabe Winslow?
No, definitely are. You know, the three-time thing really by choice. You know, I was listening to the podcast, reached out to him for a refi on our old house. And like I'll say, I mean, laid out the options, like, hey, this may be a better option, but, you know, check it out. And I checked out the alternate route that he kind of prescribed, and ended up his deal was a better deal. And then about, I don't know, 4 or 5 weeks later, we found out that our third child was on the way, which is a little bit of a surprise. So we had kind of outgrown the house that we just bought, and we, you know, moved and bought a little bit larger house and used Gabe again. And, you know, he basically came up with a game plan. I was like, hey, do we need to throw a large amount of this on the down payment to keep my payments low? He's like, what I would do is, he kind of laid out the game plan and, you know, said, hey, I'll call you basically and we'll do a refi whenever it's optimal, but I don't want you to get in a bind. It's like, just do the down payment that you're comfortable with. And so that's the route we took. And then, you know, kept in touch with him a little bit. And sure enough, you know, reached out and said, hey, I think now's the time, you know, about, you know, 4 or 5 months later. And I said, all right, if you think so, then let's roll. So, yeah, we're three-time Gabe Winslow supporters now.
All right, 3 for 3. Awesome, man. Hey, I appreciate that. And, yeah, give Gabe a shot, guys. You got the Randy Boone stamp of approval.
No, he's going to treat you straight. He's going to treat you right. I mean, I wouldn't say that if I didn't believe it, honestly. But he was a great guy. I mean, I got to meet him at the Minute Maid Classic this past, I guess, February or whenever that was, and got to chat with him a little bit. But he's going to lay it out there. And if he's not the best option, then that's fine by him. But he just wants to take care of his clients, and he knows that it'll come back to him on the back end just because he's, you know, doing what's in your best interest.
All right, Gabe, you heard this. When Randy does his fourth deal with you, he's not paying any points. All right.
Well, that was awesome. I was going to say, we may if we move here in a little while, it won't be because of another kid, but if we move here in a little bit, remember that, Gabe.
Yeah, he's going to remember it. That was awesome. Thanks, Randy. And y'all can reach him at 832-557-1095. All right, man. We got to talk about the elephant in the room. My co-host, Kevin Dunn, who's on an extended absence. He's on a sabbatical.
I was hoping he was going to show up today, but I guess he's still on vacation.
He is on vacation. He's absent without leave, man. He likes to instigate, and we were musing one time, and actually I was praising baseball. I was saying, like, I don't think people realize, we were talking about the Scalabrine Challenge. You ever heard that?
Yes.
Okay. So the Scalabrine Challenge is, just to remind all the listeners, he was a bench player for the Boston Celtics, like the 11th guy. And people were mocking him and talking, and he's like, hey, like, you don't get how good I am. So I'm going to be at a gym, open gym. All of you pickup heroes, come play me. And a bunch of local Boston pickup guys played him, and he destroyed all of them, right? Utterly destroyed them, because people don't understand how good a pro basketball player is. And so I was saying, it's the same thing with pitching, even college pitching. If you played high school baseball, that is not a preparation for a college pitcher at a major school like the University of Texas, right? You're going to make regular 4A starting player at Ed Couch Elsa look like a fool, right? And not the least of which, you'd make me look like a fool. So I was saying that, and Kevin is like, oh, so you think you could hit Randy or something like that? Or you think you could hit Austin Wood? I was like, no, I'm saying the opposite. So then we talked about, all right, how many at-bats would I need to get a hit? And so Kevin was like to bring this up and instigate. And so I think he tweeted you or texted you, and you were like, well, I don't know, but the first ball is going to be at Paul's neck, which I appreciate.
Yeah, something like that.
that's some Augie Garrido baseball, which I appreciate.
That's going to be hard for him to get a hit when it's thrown in his neck. But
that's right.
Yeah.
Well, here's how it's going to go down, Randy, in my opinion. All right. First at bat, I'm going to look like a buffoon. Second, third, all the way through the first 15 or 20 hacks, I don't think I'm going to even get a foul ball. Okay. I'm going to swing. I haven't swung a baseball bat in forever, right? I think about pitch number 32, you're going to get a little tired.
I think you're being generous on the 32, but
I think you're also going to have hit me twice already. One time you're going to throw behind my head just so I see what it feels like. You're going to hit me on the hip at least once to give me a hip pointer. There's no doubt in my mind that you'll aim there. Then you're going to throw me an Ephus ball, partly because you're tired, partly to humiliate me. I'm going to swing. I'm going to do a complete 360 and hit myself with the bat. Then you'll probably throw another Ephus ball. Tell me it's coming and I'll still miss it. I think around pitch 40, I will feebly tap a little shot that might escape the infield. I think it's possible. Then I think you'll get pissed. You'll throw at me again. And then on that throw, you're going to throw out your rotator cuff and the challenge will be over.
I don't disagree with your narrative there. I think the rotator cuff's going to go a lot sooner than you think.
Yeah.
It was already about to go, which is part of the reason why I had to stop. I'll probably just tap out and give it to Wood, honestly.
That was not part of this. I feel like Austin is still.
Are you right-handed or left-handed? Are you right-handed or left-handed?
I'm a righty.
Oh, man. I could probably get through. You know, I could flip some breaking balls up there and get through probably about 20 pitches. But yeah, no, I'm definitely tapping out. Yes, I think yesterday was the anniversary of Wood's like heroic, just unthinkable performance against Boston College. So in honor of that, yeah, I'm tapping out. I'm gonna throw 20 pitches.
Okay.
And then I'm tapping out, and he can have the next 169.
Yeah.
And then I'll maybe go get some liquid courage to numb the pain, and I'll come back for maybe another like 20.
After do a Bobby Lane.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah.
So. How many of your first 20 pitches will be at me to hit me?
It just kind of depends on how much sleep I got the night before, if, you know, if the kids cooperated.
No, these are purposeful. You're not going to be able to blame lack of sleep.
No, just one. I just need some tone.
What if my first at bat, I point over the left field wall before I step in the box?
I didn't like it, but I don't think it's going to change my approach. I would rather, I was kind of this way when I pitched anyway, but I'd rather get you out. Honestly, not saying I always did, but like if the guy had some sort of showboat or,
sure,
you know, something to him, like I'd rather just get him out. Like I know I played with plenty of guys that if you like did the most minor thing ever, like it was coming at your ribs.
That's great.
But I guess maybe I didn't throw hard enough to think it was going to hurt him. I don't know. But I just, you know, my opinion was always, I'd rather just get you out.
Did you ever get charged?
No.
You've never been charged?
No. I had a guy take a couple steps one time. And it was, gently placed a, forcing fastball in his thigh to send a message. But never. I was only in one like full-fledged brawl in my entire professional career, but it was a pretty good one.
Really?
Yeah, pretty good one. So
was this in the minor leagues?
Yes. Yeah, I was in Double-A at the time. I was in the bullpen, and some stuff went down earlier in the game, and we got the call down on the old walkie-talkie. That hey, if so and so comes up again and it's an opportunity that, you know, seems logical that we were gonna make a point. And the guy that was pitching missed pretty significantly, but it was over his head, so he got the point. And it took him about 2 seconds to charge, and of course then the bullpen's empty, everything went down. But yeah, there were some, you know, it wasn't the one where everybody came out and like, you know, started pushing each other and it's like, oh, hold me back. Like there were legitimate like pockets of people throwing haymakers. It was,
wow.
Yeah, it was a pretty intense. Ken Kasparek was actually on that team. I don't know if you remember Ken from
another. Yeah, he's a pitcher.
Yeah, another pitcher. He's from Weimer. But yeah, he was on that team. Me and him just sort of kind of found each other and were like, oh, hey, let's stand over here.
All right.
Yeah. It was interesting.
Another thing that you're featured in. So if you guys have never seen the amazing documentary Inning by Inning: Portrait of a Coach by Richard Linklater, Randy and his teammates are featured prominently in this documentary. In fact, you get a little shot. I think if I'm remembering correctly, when he's delivering one of his famous tirades.
Yeah, it kind of pans to me and I'm looking at the ground and kind of give the old like eyes up to coach and then back down. But
well, what was great about it, Randy, is you could see the football player in you, which was like I'm not happy either, but he'll get, you know, I'm just absorbing this and this will be over soon. Whereas a few of your teammates were a little traumatized.
Yeah, I think I had pitched the night before.
So you were kind of off the hook.
So, yeah, I mean, I wasn't involved in that. I mean, right. I don't think we lost the night before. So, but, you know, the speech the night before wasn't quite as to the point, we'll say.
Yeah.
But, yeah, a couple things went down in that game that I think Coach Harmon got tossed in, like, the first inning for saying something to the home plate umpires. It was, you know, tensions were pretty pretty high already. And, you know, we kind of lost it weight and, you know, went to town. But yeah, that was one thing. I mean, people bring that up all the time and it, you know, makes its rounds and I'll get like text or Facebook messages from people. Is that you? Is that you? It's like, yeah. I mean, I'll be honest with you. That's probably not even in the top 10.
Yeah, that's what I've
when
heard.
When he was like really, really like, I mean, he knew the cameras were around on that one. So, I mean, he made his point and, like, I mean, in this day and age, especially, people think it's crazy. But no, he had made much, much more passionate speeches for a good reason.
Yeah.
And I think honestly, like, not to go off tangent, but from my standpoint, I kind of came from the, you know, the Texas high school football coach's mentality of like, I had heard that before. Like, you know, if you didn't perform, you're going to hear that. Like, it was a thing. And I think most of the guys on the team had kind of some of that in them, but he only went there when he meant it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what, or at least what I appreciated about him. It's like, you know, some guys, you know, they see that stuff online. And it's like, oh, it was an act and this and that, whatever. It's like, no, if he went there, it was legit. Like, you knew that it was coming and you probably deserved it. But I mean, he cared. I mean, that was the biggest thing about it is that you knew he cared. He cared about you and he cared about you being, you know, the best that he could make you.
You know, the most interesting thing about it is if you listen to his words and not just his tone.
Yeah.
He does two very clever things. One, well, it's not clever. This is more, he's like, do you think this is about baseball? Like that's what he's like, this isn't about a game. This is about our lives. Like, how do you want to live? Do you want to be a guy who goes out and does what he's supposed to do and focuses in the moment? And do you want to live up to your potential? Or do you want to be the other guy?
Yeah, no, I mean, it goes back to his famous quote that I think Coach Pierce had on the dugout a couple years ago, saying the world treats winners different than they treat losers. And it's 100% accurate. I mean,
you're not allowed to say that anymore, but it's true.
Yeah, true. But, well, you are, because I just did. But,
yeah, there you go.
but it, I mean, it's the truth. And I don't know if he ever gave one of those speeches to where if you really sat back and thought about what he said, that something didn't resonate along the lines of that. Like, it's not about the game. It's about you not paying attention to detail because we work on that every day. Or it's not about this. You know, I mean, I'm sure you've seen the boxing match one after we just got crushed by San Diego.
Yeah.
Which has been, I guess, the opening series after we won in 05. It's like, you know, if this was a boxing match, you know, I'd be visiting you in the hospital. And that one didn't really get that, you know, impassioned as far as like volume level. But that one, I mean, that one was more probably to the point than any of the ones that he gave. It just, hey, you guys are not playing to your ability.
Right.
And the thing about it, Coach, that I think that I always respected, it always, he'd let you have it, but it always came back to him. And he'd always say that, you know, he had failed this and, you know, whatever. And you want to talk about making somebody feel about, you know, 1 centimeter tall, you know, because you knew the work that he put in and the work that Coach Harmon and, you know, the other coaches had put in. And you felt like you'd failed them. You know, I mean, you know, they had prepared you as best they could and you failed them. And, you know, just if you had any competitive spirit in you, which, I mean, let's face it, I mean, we had some really good teams with a lot of really, really good competitors. You know, it aided you. You tried to write that wrong.
I'm so glad you said that, Randy. That was the second thing. He ends that impassioned speech by saying, I'm sorry. I'm sorry I failed you. I am sorry I have utterly failed this baseball team. And then he walks out.
Yep.
That's, talk about like,
it's pretty quiet locker room for the next couple of minutes because that hit a lot of people. I'm not going to say it hit everybody in there, but it hit the people that it was supposed to hit. I'll tell you that. And it did. I mean, I can't remember the run, but we went on a little heater after that.
10 in a row.
Probably because of that. Yeah.
Yeah. What's interesting is when you go, if you go read the YouTube, God help you if you're someone who reads YouTube comments on the regular. Yeah, but
no,
if you do read them, you'll see a lot of people who are like, this is refreshing. This is what we need nowadays. And then you'll see people saying, how dare he talk to these guys? And it's like, hey, man, if that was a group of 10-year-olds.
Yeah, it's different.
That's different. That's not cool. It's a group of young men. Like, men that age went and took the beach at Normandy. Like,
right, yeah.
You can hear something, and when you listen to the content of it, that's what matters. It's not how it's being delivered. It's a guy who cares. And he's basically saying, can you please match how much I care? And then I'll be very good.
So. Yeah,
pretty interesting.
No, I mean, and, you know, there'd be games, honestly, where, you know, maybe we didn't play well, something went wrong or whatever. And it took me a little bit to get used to it. But I think the longer that you're around, coach, you kind of got it. But, you know, there'd be a game where you'd come in, you were expecting to get that, right? You're like, oh, man, you know. But you wouldn't. You'd come in and go, hey, it's baseball. You know, I made a couple of mistakes. But as long as the mistakes were reasonably made or out of, you know, physical error and not, I wasn't prepared mentally to know what I was going to do, or, you know, hey, their starter was just that good today, you know, type stuff. You know, you never got it on those occasions. It was always where if he felt you weren't living up to, you know, your potential.
Wow. That's really interesting. That's, well, they talk about him being a psychological genius.
That was the other thing about him, man. I came from a different world, with kind of the, you know, my dad was my coach a lot, growing up, and he's Army kind of guy. And it was like, hey, we're going to do one thing, we're going to do it well. And everybody's, you know, drilled this one, this, that, whatever. And, you know, the Texas high school football, it's kind of the same mentality. Like, just, you know, you work harder, and that's the answer type deal, right? So it took me a little while to get used to it. But yeah, he knew what buttons to push sometimes. And sometimes he'd make decisions to where, I mean, there was really no rhyme or reason to do it. Like, hey, we're going to move this guy three steps the other way from what the scouting report says, because, you know, Street's back door and the slider really good today. And, you know, I know the scouting report says to go in on this guy, but I think he's going to play back door slider and, you know, be a one hop ground ball shortstop, double play. Out of the inning, you just kind of look down at the other end of the dugout. How on earth did he know that? And there was, you know, not saying it worked every time, but I mean, multiple times that was the case.
Did he interact with the pitchers much, or did he give y'all a fair amount of space?
He did when it was necessary. I think he would have more, but he didn't want anybody to feel like he was stepping on the pitching coach's toes,
yeah,
so to speak. So, you know, Coach Anderson recruited me. I never had to pitch for him, because he was, you know, him and Coach Holliday flipped at Okie State. So Coach Holliday was there my freshman through junior years, and great baseball guy, but he knew enough about pitching and catching that he was probably an above average pitching coach of the college game. But when I met Skip that junior summer, it really kind of opened my eyes to somebody that was really like technical, like a pitching coach. You know, I think Coach Holliday was really good with people. I think he could get the best out of people. And I think he knew the game of baseball. But when it came to like the technical aspects of pitching, that wasn't really his strong suit. Like he was a baseball coach, not really a pitching coach. If that makes sense. And I love DH, and I think he did a good job there. But Skip just kind of took me to another level, because I mean, I was basically self-taught, honestly. I mean, I watched Nolan Ryan videos, but I didn't grow up going to pitching coaches and clinics and this and that, whatever. You know, I was kind of like tried stuff and figured it out. I basically owned, you know, my professional career and the success I had my senior year to Skip, because we kind of revamped some stuff that summer and kind of just quit. But To get back to your question, sorry, I kind of rambled, but Augie kind of gave us our space until he felt the need to interject. And then when he did, it was with purpose, and he had thought it out. It wasn't just a, hey, why don't y'all try this? It was like, I've seen this. We need to do this. It's worked in the past. This is what we're going to do type deal.
Huh. So it's really interesting. If you look at youth sports, particularly youth baseball sports now, it's almost overcoached.
Yeah, right? 100%.
I mean, they first of all, you got kids who are 12 years old getting Tommy John surgery. You should at least get your first Tommy John in your 20s like you did, right, Randy?
Yeah. Don't do it at the same time I did, but yeah.
Yeah, don't do it in the middle of your career when you're trying to make the majors. But, I mean, I feel like it's kind of amazing that you were able to turn yourself into an effective college pitcher with no tutelage. I mean, you just sort of screwed around and figured out how to throw a freaking curveball and put some movement on your fastball. Like, how did you do that?
I mean, dead honestly, I mean, it came from my dad, my mom catching me in the backyard. And I mean, I'm dead serious. Like, I watched Tom House, Nolan Ryan videos. And I was glued to the TV every night watching guys throw and this and that. But I mean, anything mechanical, honestly, like anything mechanical that I had up until probably my senior year of high school came straight off of anything Nolan Ryan or whatever related. I mean, it was high leg kick. It was, you know, the goalpost deal and, you know, all the stuff that, you know, Tom House kind of taught Nolan and just watching him throw. And I mean, the two things that I really kind of took from it was, you know, no one said any motion behind the rubber is a wasted motion. Hmm. So I was never a big step. You know, you see a lot of kids, you know, rock back and then you got to correct all that momentum going the other way. So I tried to stay as simple as I could over the rubber and just ride it downhill and stay online and let it eat. But I mean, I was a forcing curveball guy in high school. Going into college, I played a little bit more summer ball that year, at advanced levels. And, I figured out, hey, I got to locate this four seamer and it probably would help if I had a little movement to it. So I started messing around with the two seamer. And then by the time I got to Texas, my first bullpen, basically, Coach Holiday was like, you need to throw that sinker in. We're going to turn this curveball into a little bit more of a slider type thing. And that kind of started that transition. And, you know, I mean, basically I was a sinker slider guy for the next 4, 5, 6, probably 7 years. I got to kind of the end of my career in the Blue Jays organization. And when I went off and started playing overseas, and then I kind of, you know, the velo wasn't quite what it used to be. And I started throwing a cutter. And I just became cutter, changeup, curveball, just basically just screwing people's timing. It's kind of a stigma, but I mean, when you go to Venezuela and you go to Dominican, they don't care how hard you throw. Like, they'll turn it around in a heartbeat. But if you can make it look like a fastball and have it not be a fastball, you got a chance. So it just sort of morphed into what it needed to be. It goes back to, I'm sure you probably heard it, but whenever Rod said it on, I can't remember if it was on the afternoon drive or on Longhorn Blitz or whatever it was, but, you know, the life's a constant struggle between what you want to be and what you need to be to survive.
Yep.
That was my pitching career. I'm like, okay, how am I going to get people out this year? Especially before Tommy John, because before Tommy John, I mean, I'd have years where my elbow hurt. I'd have years where it really didn't. You know, I'd be high 3/4, and I'd be a little lower the next year, it's sort of whatever. But you need to sort of figure out when you know you're not going to blow stuff by people in, you know, 95 and have a filthy slider, you just figure out what your best plan of attack is. And fortunately, I had some really good pitching coaches and some hitting coaches that I alluded to earlier that kind of helped me formulate game plans. And I had some really good catchers that, you know, we'd sit down before the game and, hey, this is what we're going to do. And sometimes it worked, and other times we sat down, dug out the first inning, and threw it out the window and went back to the drawing board. So.
Well, it is amazing if you're not one of these dudes who's just touched by God, right? And you're the rest of the really good baseball players trying to figure it out and adapt and change. Because each level you go up, it's just ridiculously harder, right? And health just plays so much a part of it, especially as a pitcher. I mean, once your arm starts to kind of go bad or be off, it's just not going to be the same again, right?
Yeah, that's kind of a misconception with Tommy John now. It's like, I mean, yeah, if you get that ligament repair, then sure, your arm's probably going to be better coming off the surgery, but you're really better coming off the surgery because you rehab for a year and you're probably in the best shape you've ever been in your life.
Right.
And, you know, that was the case with me, but, you know, then, you know, the elbow chases up to your shoulder because you're putting more press, you know, stress up there. And then it's, hey, you're 28, 29, you've been throwing yourself down a hill, you know, for so, you know, however long. That's why guys like Verlander, you know, and, you know, Nolan Ryan, you know, like people that pitch that long, like, it's just mind-boggling to me that, I mean, A, they put in the work to keep their, you know, body in shape. But, I mean, they're, let's be honest, I mean, there's sort of a lot to that. Like, it's crazy that you can subject yourself to that amount of torque and everything for that long and still perform at the level that they do. It's amazing to me. Like, pretty mind-blowing, honestly.
It is amazing. I mean, a guy like Verlander in particular, just awesome. I mean,
yeah, I mean, what do you have Tommy John? He's 37. He's older than me, I think. Yeah, he's 38. Whatever. I think he's a year older than I am. So it's, and he just rolls through it. And
well,
he's the, he ever has.
Not to tangent too much. I know you're an Astros fan, but, and Gabe has forced me to become an Astros fan because we have a, we share a financial interest in season tickets, if you get my drift. But I mean, with guys like Verlander, because they haven't been really hitting the ball, and they're still playing really well. That's like, that's the pitching staff that you don't want to get in a best of seven series with.
No, and that's he. I think he had his worst start of the year like 2 days ago.
Yeah.
I just haven't pitched highlights. But yeah, that's the thing. You know, there's the season and, you know, how you roll through the season with your starting five and this and that, whatever. But yeah, I mean, I don't want to draw them, you know, especially if you get a short series, you get a 5-game series. And I was actually talking to Wood about this yesterday to kind of relate this back to Texas baseball. They're set up better right now for the super regional than they are the regional.
Because mm-hmm.
they can figure out a way to get through the regional, and you got to figure out, you just got to win two games in that super. And if Hanson and Gordon throw good, you know, you can hide the pen a little bit, sneak Stevens in there, you know, figure it out. I mean, you just got to win two of those three. You know, regional, you get pushed to fourth game, then you're kind of, you're back into kind of where you were in the Big 12 tournament. But I mean, certain teams set up better for playoff series and stuff like that. And then there's a bunch of guys that, you know, they got five really solid starters, and it's going to play very well for them over the course of 162 games.
Yep.
But when you get in the playoffs, it's an average guy each night. You know, they're not trotting out some guy that really scares you. Now, yeah, if you play them in 10 games and they can run those five guys out there twice, yeah, they're probably better than you. But if you only play four, then really do you good to have that depth. But it does set up well for you over the 162, which that's where the trade deadline and all that stuff comes into play for GMs, which is tricky.
Yeah. All right. I need a minor league story out of you.
Oh,
we can go overseas edition, because I guarantee you got something for that as well.
The overseas one's probably...
I do want to mention, Randy, I did
some research.
Hold on. I did do some research, and I found out two things. Your first pro baseball team that you played for, what was their name and their mascot?
We were the Lansing Lugnuts.
The Lansing Lugnuts. And this is deep research. You're going to be impressed, Randy. You know what the Yoakum yearbook is called? Your mascot is the Bulldog.
Man, I had journalism my senior year, and I actually wrote articles on that thing, and I still can't remember the name of it.
Probably for good reason.
It's not anything related to Bulldog. I don't remember that.
Oh, it is related to Bulldog.
Oh, it is? Sure. Well, I got nothing there.
The Bow Wow.
The Bow Wow. Yeah, I wouldn't have got that.
But you remember the Lansing Lugnuts. Who could forget the Lansing Lugnuts?
No, it's pretty tough to remember that when you got a big bolt running around the field every half inning.
That's amazing. No,
my minor league team names are pretty interesting. So I'm still trying to figure out what a Fisher Cat is. But
That was a New Hampshire team, right?
That was New Hampshire, yes, sir.
All right.
You're gonna have to narrow it down. What do you want to hear?
All right.
Bus story, travel story. That's my one caveat. You gotta narrow it for me, because there's I'll sit here and think for an hour before I come up with one. Tell you.
Let's see. Just give me something funny. Funny. Not anything too outrageous. We'll keep it PG-13. I'm sure you guys had some Susan Sarandon, Bull Durham types hanging around the club, the locker room, but the clubhouse. So we'll keep it PG-13.
This probably isn't the funniest one that I have, but I'll give you two.
Bring it.
End of my career, I played independent ball for about half a season after I was done with Toronto, and we had the opportunity to go to Taiwan and play in that league over there. So my wife went with me, and I think we were about 2 or 3 days in over there, and they have these, as you know, street markets.
Oh no!
We're not going to go down that road. But
did they have any bio labs?
But there are street markets over there. And so it was literally like a parade type atmosphere or whatnot. And we're walking down the deal, and they have, you know, food carts and this and that. And, you know, they had, you know, their wontons and your typical, you know, your noodle dishes. And, you know, then, you know, Taiwan's real big on like the whole fish. Like, hey, why would we take the eyes off this thing? Like, let's just cook it. Yeah, no. And then we passed out. A deal where they had chickens and like what you would see in an HEB, like the rotisserie chickens, except they don't bother taking the heads off them over there. So that, you know, that was interesting. And so we get to this two doors down, there's this meat tray, and the guy's like hibachiing it up basically. And he's got a little flame and he's doing this. I walk up to it and I was like, that looks really good. He's got, you know, it's like some soy sauce or something mixed in there. And this really ain't going to play that well because it's an audio podcast, but you'll get it since we're on video here. But I walk up and I was like, you know, hey, what is that? So they gave us these index cards when we went over there. It basically had like the Chinese writing for, this is the address to the ballpark, this is the address to your stadium. And, you know, over there, like a vast majority of people under 30 spoke English because it's taught at schools. But, I mean, obviously you're taxi drivers and whatever, or, you know, older, you know, indigenous people in there, just straight, you know, Chinese speaking. So we had these, you know, these index cards for everything. And I'm like scrolling through my index cards for like a, hey, what is that food index card? I didn't have one. So I just pointed at it and he looks at me and you just see him. He just like straight sizes me up like American guy. What can I sell this to him? And he puts his hands on his head and does like a deer thing. And I looked at it and I was like, I've seen a lot of venison in my day and that is not venison. And we kept walking.
That was a cat.
but yeah, that was his American go-to apparently. He's like, hey, I got an American here. I'm going to tell him this is a deer.
This is venison. That's awesome. Yeah. Well, if you hadn't grown up in Texas, you know, what would you say, Yoakum's Gulf Coast? What would you call that region?
I don't really know. We're about an hour and a half from the coast, so kind of, but not really. It's kind of a weird little area. Like, we're like right in the middle of everywhere, but close to nothing.
Yeah,
we're about two hours from Corpus, 2 hours from Houston, two from Austin, two from San Antonio, two from San Antonio.
But you know what venison looks like.
But yes, no, I'm it was not that. I promise you that. And then the other one, we had a guy that had just got called up to Double A, and one of the veterans on the team decided he was going to freeze all of his clothes.
I'm a big fan of hazing. I know that's unpopular. Yeah, I'm a huge fan.
Yeah, there were some things or whatever, but anyway, so he froze all of his clothes, and this guy goes out and throws, like, first game, and, you know, up at the level, he throws, like, 8 shutout innings, like, just dealt. And he comes back into the locker room, and he's just so happy. He's like, man, and everybody, you know, everybody's happy for him, because we knew him from spring training. He was kind of a guy that we thought should have made the team. You know, he should have been at, you know, in Double A at the time, but, you know, they kept him in high or whatever. And he comes in, he's just on 5-9, he comes in his locker, and, you know, his clothes are just sitting there, just like block of ice, just melting, you know, obviously all over his locker. he just melts. It's like, oh, man, I can't lose. So anyway, he comes back the next day, and to his credit, he did not enlist anybody's help, nothing. And he had the guy who did it, which I don't know how he found out who the instigator was, but he did. And he had his entire locker set up in the toilet stall. Talking like clothes hangers on the thing, like his gloves were set on top of the toilet, like his cleats were hanging off the little flush valve, name tag, everything.
That's perfect.
But I was like, hey, you handled that about as well as you could. But
that's the key to a haze, right?
No, yeah. Yeah, you just accept it and you handle it well, and you go down the road and everybody's fine with it. It's like, okay, we did our deal, and then you proved you could handle it, so you're one of us now, we're good. But yeah, the guys that freak out, that doesn't...
Well, once you prove that you're fun to screw with, it's over.
No, it's over.
Yeah,
then you end up with the same trick, except for they're playing Fungo with your frozen clothes in the parking lot.
It escalates.
Which happened to the next guy because he freaked out. And then
that's awesome.
Yeah, we were playing soft toss in the parking lot with those instead of just, you know, moving on down the road. But I'm sure there's some better ones, but I can't think of anything right now.
That's awesome.
That I can repeat.
All right, when you think of your better ones, you got to let me know. You got to return. This was a blast.
Do you need a realtor in Central Texas? Of course you do. We all need a realtor in Central Texas, even those of us who live in Dallas or Houston or San Francisco or Denver, Colorado. You need to go to Central Texas anyway. And the reason is Laura Baker is a fantastic realtor. She's great at what she does. She's a member of the elite Andy Allen team for Keller Williams. You can reach her at 512-784-0505. Talk with Laura if you're thinking about putting your house on the market. This is a great time to get market comps. If you're looking to buy in the market, you need all the help you can get. Call Laura, and it's 512-784-0505.
How can we f***ing get picked off at first base? How can you do that? What's that about? What do you think you're f***ing with here? This isn't about some game. This is about our lives. Don't you get it? Don't you get it? You don't have a choice. When I tell you to take, you take. Don't tell me you don't see it. You look. You understand? I don't give a... Like I said, 15 minutes from now, you don't give a... You'll walk out of here. I gotta live with this embarrassing game the rest of my life. I have totally failed you guys. We got beat at every single part of this. Everything. Infield play, two out hitting, everything. Totally stupid. I'm sorry. I apologize. I have totally let you down.